Connie Willis here on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest tonight is Jem Penniston of the Rendlesham Enigma. That's his latest book that's about to come out. He's been working on it for 4 years. I thought it was three. It was even worse, 4 years. However, I got to read the first three chapters that still was being put together, and I guess it still is because it's not out yet, but he took me there. He really took me there. It was absolutely amazing, the detail. And I felt what he was feeling. I was seeing what he was seeing. And I don't know that I could have done what Jem was doing. Now, he was totally doing his job and checking it out. He was there for security reasons. And I got to say, holy moly, he was absolutely doing his job and keeping us secure. And I'm glad you were there on the front lines, Jem, because when you were talking about that there was this light that you walked into, and then you touched this thing. You actually pushed it to try to move it to see, if you could shake it and rock it. To put your hands on this thing that should not even exist, it doesn't compute in your mind, but however, doing your job, keeping up with what you're supposed to do, writing this down in your notebook, which, by the way, the book will show you pictures of his notes and his writing. I still think you were cool, calm, and collected. And I just find that amazing. I just think, Jem, I'm impressed.
I was not cool, calm. I was not.
It came across that way. I mean, anybody else would have just, stood back and watched. You went up and touched the darn thing.
I tell you what, after that episode with the light, after touching it, I didn't touch it after that.
That's when you put your hand on the dot, like the triangle, and then a special light came up. So what you said, something, you started getting ones and zeros.
It was a momentary here's the thing. These impressions, it was like, I guess looking back in retrospect, it was, obviously in some type of communication. So it was a hell of a night, let me tell you.
Was it telepathy, or was it more of a download of information?
I don't know. I don't know. It's just what I could see this in my mind's eye. It was not like something that you're looking at. It's something that was like internal. It's hard to explain. But as you know, with three chapters, and we got a lot more done than that. I mean, we're probably going to have this book out, I would guess, March 1st. As you know from reading those three chapters, I'm just glossing over all this. I mean, this is not the detail of the book. I'm trying to, hit the main points for you.
And I'm trying to take you back to those cool little things I wanted to ask you for sure. Because if I would have seen that type of light, you talked about light that didn't, our light, if you, flash a flashlight, just keeps going, right? You were talking about the light kind of was enclosed in itself.
Yeah, it was a really strange phenomena. But certain things did stop. I mean, like the feeling of, having labored movements and that stopped after I started examining the craft. But I still couldn't hear it, like sound. My focus was on the craft itself, though. Even though I was doing occasional security checks, letting them know it was okay. I was under observation from the East Gate with Sergeant Chandler. He relayed to me afterwards that, he seen everything that was going on. So,
did you later, you're talking about the ones and the zeros, did you later write, were you able to write all those down in a certain sequence or no?
Yeah, I can get to that, but let's get that craft out of here. Let, let me tell you what I did with the craft. I mean,
okay.
yeah, because it's something that, for me, Rendlesham happens not like 38 years ago. It happened 4 days ago.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sometimes I go a week, 2 weeks. But no, and it just goes, plays over and over and over again. You know, it's crazy. Anyway, I did the examination, and then I started seeing movement, like with the lighting, the globular lights started to appear again, and things like that. And it seemed like it was powering up. That's my conclusion. I heard nothing, but it seemed to be more active. So I backed away from it, and I got down. I got down on the ground. I didn't know if I activated something or I didn't know. And then it started generating the globular light started going through it again, and there was a brighter light, white light coming out of it again. And then it just picked up off the forest floor, and then moved back through the trees, like about 20 feet, which I still don't know how it did that, because those trees were close. I mean, they were like 4 or 5 feet apart. And then it got back about 20 feet, then it lifted up and went up to the canopy of the trees, made a slight right turn, and in a blink of an eye, it disappeared. Then I heard back to the right of me, I heard branches break. I started hearing sound again, and it was the airman with me, and he ran up beside me, and he acquired, according to him, the craft again, and he took off. And we were a team. That's one of the things you don't do. You don't break up the team. And so I went after him to stay, keep the integrity of the team. And we had went over a double fence. We went into a farmer's field. I fell in the field, and I got soaked. It was like waterlogged. And
I thought that only happened in the movies, but it happened to you.
Yeah, it happened to me. And then we got quite a distance away, past the farmer's field, past the farmhouses that were out there. And the airman says, "Oh, there it is." And I said, "Where?" And he says, "There." And I says, "Where?" And he's pointing over to the opposite direction, toward the coastline. And I said, "Where?" And finally, I looked down his, from his finger, pointing at it, and he was pointing at the lighthouse. There's a lighthouse that was like 4 or 5 miles away. I went, "That's not it." And I turned over to the right, I seen it sitting over the canopy of the trees about, 400 yards away. And then it moved out, at extreme speed across the, toward the coast. And that was the last time we've seen it. So immediately, I started hearing radio transmissions from the control center, and I said we lost sight of it. It went over the the coastline. They told us to return. So on the way back, it was pretty much no conversation. I mean, what can be said? The airman with me was saying, "What are we going to tell him, Sergeant Pester? What are we going to tell him? What are we going to tell him?" I says, "We are not going to tell them nothing." I says, "I'm going to go ahead and report this. Okay, I'm in charge." And I said, "All you do is stand there." Because I was worried at that point in time, now, how am I going to explain what just happened? I can't use the fatal words of UFO. Can't even use that. That would be a career ender right there.
Why is that? Why did you already know that as well, when you know that's what it was?
Well, it wasn't a UFO, was it?
Well, I mean, you don't know that it was alien, but you knew it was unidentified.
It had landed. I mean, it wasn't flying. You know, it did fly. I mean, but I mean, when I first seen it, it was on the ground. What it was is, I kept it generic, like craft, craft is okay. Craft, right. no origin. Yeah. That worked. And, then the posting, we headed in and, on the posting bus, and then the law enforcement guy went with law enforcement guys back. And I did my notes on the posting bus coming back with the other guys, and I finished up my notes because I was going to do an incident complaint report, of what happened out there. And so I had to write all the times back down on a sheet of paper, and I was going to give them to Sergeant Coffey at CSC. And when I arrived there, I went to give him my notes then. Sergeant Coffey said, no, I already got the 1569 done. So that told me he heard everything. And sure enough, the times were right and everything. So he did hear all the transmissions. And later on, I talked to him years later, and, of course, he confirmed all that.
What about all the pictures you took?
Well, I turned in the film to the base photo lab. They were, when I went to pick them up a couple of days later, they were all whited out. I thought it was suspicious, but I later found out Monroe Nevels, Staff Sergeant Monroe Nevels, he worked disaster preparedness. I didn't know this at the time, but of course I finally find it out after the fact. The base commander had ordered him out on that morning to investigate the first, the contact and get his evaluation. So he was out there all day, and he, was observing, different things like, the branches were broke, and there was indentations on the ground, pod markings, three of them, and so that was his investigation. I just talked to him last week about it. Matter of fact, Monroe wrote a whole chapter on it, so it's in details as well. And so anyway, the I had went back out that morning. I went and got plaster of Paris from my landlord, and I went and poured plaster of Paris cast of the landing pods where the indentures were. I wanted something for myself because I was starting to doubt everything that happened.
Do you still have that?
Yes, I have. I have one, and I gave one to Colonel Halt, and the other one was missing from my household goods when I shipped back to the States.
Ooh.
So, yeah.
That's creepy.
It took 7 months for my household goods to get to my next base. Unheard of. That's in the book, too. It's, the aftermath's all recorded in the book. So anyway, after that, I'm home, and I'm getting ready to go to bed, and I can't sleep. I'm just too wound up about it. I'm starting to see these ones and zeros. I don't know, even when I close my eyes, that's what I'm seeing. And I think I laid down for a couple hours. I got back up. It was like late at night. I made a pot of coffee. That was really good. That was a smart move. If you can't sleep, make a pot of coffee. So I'm sitting at my dining room table, and I said, let me look at my notes again. So I grabbed the notebook, and I'm going back through, and I'm looking at all the notes I took. And, after I got through them all, I could close my eyes, and I could see those ones and zeros. I said, I think I can write those down. And I started writing them down. And the bizarre thing was, as I wrote them down, I started feeling better. It felt good. And matter of fact, the pen I was using, it clogged up or whatever, it wasn't working. I'm like frantic to find another pen in the drawer. So I can continue to do this. And I actually thought, I don't know, I was losing my mind. I thought it was, from the trauma. I don't know. I thought it was, I was in a lot of trouble. I knew I could go to the base hospital. What do I tell them? I had a encounter with craft unknown origin, and now I'm seeing ones and zeros. I mean, oh my God.
I'm surprised they didn't do anything with you afterwards anyway, just to make sure you were okay from maybe possible even radiation or anything.
Well, we were walking and talking. That's the other thing. When Monroe Nevels went out there, he went out, his investigation continued into the night, and that's when Colonel Halt joined him. He had radiation equipment, and the only place there was radiation, Monroe goes in complete detail. I don't really know what type it was, gamma and all this other stuff he's telling me. But it was only at the actual landing site where the craft was. It wasn't even 10, more than a couple of feet from the landing site, and that's when the radiation stopped. And he went, and then Monroe also took pictures, and he is an amateur photographer, and he took that film home, and he developed it himself. And then I find out that none of his turned out either. They were whited out. And Monroe said that's because of the radiation. So I'm going to take his word on it. He's a straight-up guy. He was a Marine, and he cross-trained in the Air Force. He's meticulous on the investigation. He took notes, too. And he was to report back to Colonel Conrad his findings. So, And they also explained why the craft was warm to touch, because it was probably hot, it's probably had it because of the radiation. These are conclusions about the radiation.
And more to come here too, more conclusions, more theories, more thoughts. We're going to ask him, Jim Peniston here, his thoughts of what he thought they were, what he was around, what he thought it was. I mean, this is an incredible story, an incredible account. Stay with us. It's Coast to Coast AM. It's Coast to Coast AM. Connie Willis here. Very happy to be here along with Jim Peniston talking about the Rendlesham Enigma, that's the name of his new book coming out. He's putting together right now. Been taking him just about 4 years or right around 4 years. I got to read three of the chapters, and they were just incredible. Really, I'm really looking forward to reading the rest of it. Now, Jim, I don't know anybody else that has touched one of these things that we don't know what it is. Through all this time and through all these years, have you ever figured out what it was or found out what it was, or will we ever know what it was?
Well, I'll tell you what, the very two questions that were initially in my mind still remain. It's who are they and where do they come from? It's the same questions as today. I don't know.
So you do not believe it was human in any way?
Well, I'll tell you what, my thoughts on that are, the craft had similarities that only our aircraft has. It had a dorsal fin that went up, like our aircraft have Ariens and stuff like that. I mean, it was triangular. Triangular crafts are pretty normal nowadays, aren't they? The stealth ones and that. But then in the same, and why mark the craft? Why put a marking on it? Humans do that.
I'm surprised about lights too. I mean, we use lights so we can see, but this stuff, it was kind of flashing like a carnival.
Yeah, it's and the other thing is, you know, why was my night vision ruined? Light does
and,
that. I mean, so this can't be light. I don't know. I see, but
right.
It appeared to be light, you know. I
well,
don't know the answer to that.
You talked about too, like this milky white light that you walked into, and you had, which I found, holy cow, that's incredible. But you had mentioned too that, well, at one point while you were walking to the light, all the animals had kind of run past you.
Yeah, they were like in a frenzy. That's why it was noticeable, the absence of sound when I got to the craft. It was just, yeah.
And the absence of sound, and you even said too, with the absence of sound, you could not even hear your own footsteps crunching anything on the ground. And you were in the forest.
That's correct. But the one thing that did, I did have recall on, we went back to the Runnison Forest in 2010. It was the 30th anniversary. We were doing a film shoot with Ancient Aliens, and so we went over there for a couple weeks to film. And when I went back out there, it was like going to the scene of the crime. I had the other person I was with me, and you know, you start having a recall, and I had total recall of what was going on. And one of the things that I did remember from that 2010 visit is the smell that was out there, and the smell was like the smell of that aircraft engine would have after it's been run up for, you know, a test cell or something like that.
Mm.
And it smelled like hot metal. And that was one of the recall things that I had in 2010.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's bizarre. But minus the sound, but you know, you still smell things. That's that's incredible.
It is. Well, you know, I like to connect the dots to all these different genres out there and all these things that we talk about here on Coast to Coast. And mm-hmm. when you had mentioned that it was quiet, you couldn't even hear your own footprints in the forest, that you're going to hear yourself, you know, stepping on a twig or something that is going to crunch. It reminded me of something, and that you'll probably find this interesting too. When I was, the very first time I went out and people took me to go Bigfooting to learn what that was all about, I was in a camper, and that camper was rocked 4 times. And when it was rocked, I was asleep. Next thing I know, I was awake, and I thought, why am I awake, and why do I feel so good? And then the camper was rocked. Everything was still. Everything was totally still. And then it was rocked again. And I said to myself, well, okay, yeah, that rock just happened. Somebody rocked this camper. Huh, I wonder if they'll do it from the other side. That'll mean something. Maybe I'm just dreaming this. And then it was rocked from the other side. Now, when I looked back at it, I went, oh, my gosh, I never heard anybody, any sound, walk from one side of the camper to the other. We were out in the middle of the woods. If you were going to walk, you would have stepped on a twig, a branch, leaves, something. There was no sound. So I find that interesting, that what I experienced that night, no other sounds. And a lot of people experience that, no other sounds. Where did that big creature go that was 12 foot tall? Why do we not hear that walk away? I find that interesting that you also said you walked into something, and when you were there, and it was so still that you didn't even hear your own feet walking in the woods.
No, never heard a thing. No.
Interesting. Telepathy as well, downloads as well. The same, the alien story out of Urhanga, Brazil, those funky aliens. They were very different looking. That one was captured with a hurt leg, and the doctor apparently had been downloaded information into his head. And that sounds similar to what you were talking about when you had your hand on that print.
There's some cases that I follow, and mainly because of the ones from 2007 when I was doing a project with James Fox, and we went to the National Press Club then. And the 14 people that were with me are military people from all over the world and from equivalent like NASA people and stuff like that. And they had some incredible stories, accounts to tell. So there's some, and by the way, we're still friends. We still in contact with each other, the ones that are alive anyway, and we still talk. But getting back to the Rendlesham case, so after I did that, I wrote those ones and zeros down as much as I could. It just stopped, and I felt great. And so I ended up getting a good few hours of sleep. And then I got a call that Sunday night. The incident happened, I think, on a Friday. And that Sunday night, I got a call from Sergeant Hudson, who worked in the orderly room. And I was supposed to report back to OSI, Office of Special Investigation, on the Monday. And then I also had to go up and meet the base commander and wing commander. That seemed normal because they're going to be asking questions, so they want to get debriefed, so no problem. So the Sunday morning, I go back into the base, and I took Airman Burroughs with me for a ride in. He didn't have a car, so I gave him a ride. He had to run around and do on base. I went to my OSI appointment. And when I went down there, I know all the agents, by the way, the interview I got was not by the agents I knew. There were two other people, and they told me pretty much if I write down everything, I do a statement, write down everything, exactly what I seen and what happened, this goes away. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to go away. So I wrote down a handwritten four-page statement on legal paper, and I gave it to them, and they said they're gonna go back and type it up, and I thought that was gonna be it, and so I'm waiting, and they come on back maybe 15-20 minutes later, and they have a typed statement that's like a half a page in single space. And it's generic. It tells about, 50 meters here, craft, mechanical in nature, things like that. And I says, this is not what happened. And they said, this is the story you're going to tell because this is an active investigation right now. And this is what you tell from now on. And I said, well, I got an appointment, with the base commander and stuff. And he said, this is the story you tell. It's an active investigation. And it goes away. I said, no problem. So he says, read it a few times, memorize it, and that's what you want to tell the command element. Then went down to base commander's office and met with him, met with the deputy base commander, Colonel Hall, and the wing commander, Colonel Williams, and I kept it generic, like what that statement they gave me, and they were satisfied with it. They never asked one question. I couldn't believe that.
You think they were just kind of making sure you were going to stick with that story, and they already knew what you had seen?
I wonder. I tell you what, I met General Williams. He's a Major General retired. Unfortunately, he passed away on Thanksgiving. I met him in Tucson when I was out there maybe, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. I can't remember exactly. And we set up a lunch with him. And one of the things I did is I apologized for not telling him the truth. I said, I was under orders. And he says, hey, we all follow orders. And no problem. Don't worry about it, Jim. And I felt really good about that because, it always did bother me not, being completely up front. But
that's great that you had closing for that. That's good.
Yeah, it was great. And, matter of fact, the Rendlesham Enigma book is, it's got, stuff from General Williams in there. Colonel Conrad was active in the book, too, helping us with it as a contributor. And, of course, Sergeant Neville's and also Colonel Hall. So we got the players on, that were involved with boots on the ground pretty much in the book. The interesting thing is once the debriefs were done, there was only, of the people that had top secret clearances, it was myself, Sergeant Neville's, the base commander, obviously, the deputy base commander, and the wing commander. And so we were privy to we were constantly being talked, either we were in the loop on the aftermath. So, and it was shortly after a couple of weeks, I also my lieutenant comes to me and says, I want you to apply for this job in plans and programs for the security police. And I said, well, what is it? The NCIC position. I said, I don't know nothing about writing plans. And he said, no, apply for it. And I said, okay. So he set up an appointment. I went down and I applied. I met with, I think it was Tech Sergeant Biardi at the time, and they were getting ready to PCS, permanent change of station, and they needed a new NCOIC. The interview was mainly a cup of coffee and small talk, and I thought that was it. And a couple of days later, when I went to work, to draw my weapon, and the lieutenant says, you don't need to draw your weapon. He says, you're ready to do it. I says, what? He goes, yeah, you got the job. Congratulations. I says, what? How did I get that job? Yeah. So they said, I got down there and I talked to Sergeant Biardi, and then he said, oh, don't worry about it. We're going to set you up and have you trained by the wing plans officer, Major Chad Smith. And over the course of the next 2-3 months, that's what we did. And that's the position I had. And it was a unique position because in that position, we had certain meetings every month and the reports that were due. And those reports were turned over to Colonel Hall by his position. And so I got, and obviously we still talked about the incident, even though we were treating it as top secret. I was privy to a lot of information. And I'll tell you what, the other thing I did, and I've always done this, at least from the military time, is I always kept journals. And so I had my journals to go through and writing this book. Plus, in 90, I retired in November, October 31st of, October 31st, 93. And, the new job I have is I was a vice president for security operations for this firm, and my boss, who owned the company, he was an MP in the Army at one time, deputy sheriff. He's now a state senator. He said, you need to talk to the Pilots Association about this, because he was familiar sort of with the case. He heard rumors. And I said, okay, so he talked me into talking to the Pilots Association. I gave a briefing on it. The stuff in my notebook and things like that. And it actually felt a little bit better talking about it rather than keeping it in. And I think we also did a Rotary Club after that. And then about 94, I was starting to get I was having trouble sleeping, so I went to my medical doctor about it. I was only getting like 2-3 hours of sleep, and it just wore on me. And she said she couldn't help me, but she did a referral, and it was to a psychiatrist and that. So I said, yeah, I'll do that. And so I started seeing a psychiatrist over about the sleep disorder, And because I had to get sleep. You know, you can't only go so long with 2 hours sleep a night.
I can't believe they didn't do it earlier with you. I just can't believe they didn't do anything.
It didn't affect me like that till after I was out. And I didn't know what, you know, the sleep disorder, who knows where it was from.
Yeah,
anyway,
okay.
During the course of this the treatment with the psychiatrist, she says, I want to do a regression. She says, something in your past is causing this. She says, I'm pretty sure of it. And I was thinking, oh, my God, please don't tell me I was abused or something as a child or something like that. You know, I was like, all kinds of things running through my mind. Anything, but I wasn't even thinking about Rendlesham.
You weren't even thinking about that?
No, I didn't think about that at all. And so we did, there was two-hour sessions with that.
And hold on a second here. We're going to come back and ask you more about that. Will you stick around for us?
Sure, I will.
Okay, excellent. We want to hear about this. He really blocked that out to forget about that. We got more to come here with Jim Pennison on Coast to Coast AM. I'm Connie Willis.